Urgent care, as a specialty, much like our colleagues in general practice or emergency medicine, is one of the true generalist specialties. We see all organ systems, all ages, all genders, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. It is that breadth of knowledge, coupled with the need for adaptability and living with uncertainty, that results in the urgent care workforce having a wide range of interests outside of medicine. In previous profiles, we've spoken with Dr. Dinesh Dionarain about his love of wilderness medicine and his time working at the highest clinic in the world on Mount Everest. We've also spoken with Dr. Claire Russell about her time on board the world's first all-female round-the-world yacht crew. So travel and adventure are trusted companions for the urgent care physician. And today we have another example of one of our fellows traveling the world. Dr. Tamsin Lilly is a fellow with a drive to use her urgent care training to help deliver and support health initiatives in parts of the world less fortunate than ours. I managed to catch up with Tamsin, who is currently in Malawi, to find out about her medical journey, how she discovered urgent care, and how she is realizing her childhood dream of improving health in remote parts of the world. So I'd like to welcome to the podcast of the Royal New Zealand College of Urgent Care, Dr. Tamsin Lilly. Tamsin is a fellow of our college and is doing something very interesting, which is why we're going to have a chat to her today. And it's currently 7:30 in the evening in New Zealand, but she's a fair distance away from us at the moment in Malawi in Africa. So welcome, Tamsin. What time is it with you? And it's the morning, I believe. So good morning.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you for inviting me onto the podcast today. So it's 8:30 in the morning this side. So ready to start the day.
Well, we'll get into why you're in Malawi in a minute, but I mentioned that you're a fellow of the college. But let's just maybe start with telling us a bit about yourself and your medical journey and where it started and how you ended up in Malawi.
Yeah, absolutely. I studied medicine at the University of East Anglia in Norwich in the UK. And had kind of had an experience as a 10-year-old on an overseas visit in a scout group where we worked with a aid worker who was a doctor, and she had set up this local clinic in a very rural area of Romania. And I remember just being so inspired by her and what she had done and all the people that she was helping. And really, so from that point onwards, kind of had always had the ambition to become a doctor. But obviously, as a young child, you never know whether you're going to meet all of those kind of academic requirements to get in. But fortunately, I did. And so started on that career journey. I integrated during my medical training. So I did a master's degree in international public health at the University of Sydney. And then once I qualified, subsequent to that, I did the diploma of tropical medicine. So sort of all my training, at every opportunity I've had, I've really tried to kind of grasp the global health world and get more qualifications that will make me useful in that environment. And sort of embarked on a journey to New Zealand after I'd done the tropical medicine diploma. So I studied in Uganda and Tanzania. I did the East African one. And I remember getting back to the UK and just feeling like I had grown a lot as a person and was back working at the hospital that I was working in, and just felt that life had sort of stood still. And so started looking for other opportunities. and had emailed, like blanket emailed many, many hospitals, kind of Australia and New Zealand. I tried to get work in South Africa. But at that particular time when I was applying, you had to take extra exams for medical practice in South Africa. There were only a few universities in the UK that they accepted, and my university hadn't been one of them. So I'd missed kind of the cutoff for those exams. So as I say, started blanket emailing hospitals in Australasia, and Rotorua were the only ones that got back to me. And so started my journey in New Zealand. And when I first arrived, kind of 2015, just really, really loved the hospital, a very friendly environment, felt like I was valued and was learning a lot, getting a lot of exposure to different things. So I hadn't really anticipated staying as long as I have, but have been really grateful for sort of all the opportunities that New Zealand has thrown me, and obviously now kind of embarked on the urgent care pathway and managed to get my fellowship last year. So yeah, that's sort of my medical training in a nutshell, really.
So does urgent care fit in with your global travel and the work that you're currently doing? Is it a neat fit with your career goals when you moved to New Zealand and discovered that there was this urgent care?
Yeah, so I remember being really excited when I found out that there was an urgent care college. It just seemed to fit a lot of things that I wanted to do. It was the very sort of generalist specialty, and I definitely didn't want to focus down on an individual area. I had been considering ED training, but again, at the time with my visa that I was on, I wasn't able to sort of embark on that journey. And I think with hindsight, actually, that was a really good thing. I don't think that would have actually suited me completely. And urgent care does. When I initially started, I was able to count some things that I'd already done in the past, so it automatically felt good to kind of have got some of those requirements ticked off. And then sort of thinking more towards the future, like I've been itching to sort of get back overseas and do global health work, and so sort of enabling me to get that fellowship pretty quickly, I guess, in terms of enabling me to count retrospective experience was really a blessing, kind of in terms of what I wanted to do future career-wise. So I'm really, really happy that I've chosen urgent care and that I've embarked on that journey, and of all the opportunities that it's given me as well, with the flexibility and working in different areas. So yeah, it's definitely not been a decision I've regretted, and is definitely one that has been right for me at this particular point in time.
And that brings us neatly to where you are at the moment. I mentioned at the start that you're in Malawi and recently finished your fellowship and then jetted off to Malawi in the middle of a global pandemic, which can't have been an easy thing to do. So do you want to tell us why you're in Malawi and what you're doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Malawi is a country that I'm quite familiar with. I did my medical elective here in 2010, and I've been involved in an NGO, non-governmental organization, since about 2009 when I was at university. So the NGO is called Medic to Medic, and we sponsor trainee health workers in Malawi who are at risk of dropping out due to poverty. So sort of have been coming here every year or so for our monitoring and evaluation visits, visiting the students, visiting the faculties. And prior to the pandemic, had been planning to come out in March 2020, when obviously the world had other plans for everybody at that particular point in time. So the plan at that point had been to set up our local office, get our administration team sort of up and running, which I feel is really important in terms of sustainability for the organisation, having a local team, being able to provide employment in an area where there are really high rates of unemployment in Malawi and poverty. But unfortunately, obviously, with the global pandemic, wasn't able to get out here at kind of March 2020 time. So all of those projects and plans had been delayed. And obviously, each country has been on their own individual pathway in terms of what COVID means. So for me, that meant I was in the UK visiting family sort of prior to hopefully coming out to Malawi in March. That meant that I was I'll say marooned, but that is not the right word, because it meant more time with family, which was really nice, but was sort of marooned in the UK while we kind of all navigated those travel changes and requirements and restrictions. Came back to New Zealand, thought I'm just going to work as much as I can, try and sort of save as much money as I can for when the time comes that's right, when I am volunteering. So with Medic to Medic, I'm not paid while I'm here, so I'm self-funding everything. And then the timing was right, sort of in September 2021, to come back out here. So Malawi has had its own border closures, its own restrictions. It's certainly not as strict as like the developed world has been. It doesn't really have that luxury of furlough schemes or anything else. But September 2021 was the right time. Borders had opened, and so came out here to sort of set up the local office, find a house that we could rent, get kind of the furniture, the employment side going, get the registration process started with the NGO Council of Malawi so that we can start fundraising in country, and again, sort of increase not only our sustainability of the organization in the longer term, but also sort of financial sustainability and less reliance on international funds. I think a global pandemic has sort of shown that when we are so deeply connected all together, all around the world, and sort of whilst Medic to Medic hasn't been hit in the same way that some other charities have, like we're very small, and in some ways that protects us a little bit from financial vulnerability. But in terms of having to cancel events for fundraising and things, if anything does happen internationally to those funds, like I don't want Medic to Medic to end. It's just, it has such a vital role to the health education of the most vulnerable here. So in trying to set up those processes and initiatives for fundraising in country has just been something that I've been really passionate about in terms of wanting to make sure that it continues in the longer term. So anyway, so that's sort of how I found myself out in Malawi. And I thought I would probably just need 3 months for that. But kind of just on that 3 month mark, Omicron happened. I wasn't able to get back to New Zealand from here because I'm not a citizen. So I managed to extend my visa in Malawi due to all of those restrictions. And it was probably actually, for me anyway, a sort of silver lining in disguise, because I hadn't reached the end point of all the things that I wanted to get done while I was here. So actually probably did need longer than 3 months with hindsight. And that's kind of given me an opportunity to stay on and get those things sorted. As I tell a lot of people, Malawi goes at her own pace, and you can't rush certain processes and systems, no matter how sort of organized or persistent you are or very efficient you are on WhatsApp. So it's actually been really good staying on longer and kind of making more connections and setting things up in a little bit more detail.
You've mentioned the travel difficulties of a pandemic and the financial difficulties, but obviously your charity is involved in training the next generation of Malawi medics. So how has that population been affected? Is the medical community in Malawi, have they been affected significantly by the pandemic in terms of people either dropping out or struggling to cope?
Yeah, absolutely. That's probably a whole podcast conversation in itself, but I'll try and give a sort of summary of all of that. So in terms of the effect of COVID on the local population, I would say it's definitely exacerbated poverty. So one example, I met a couple who were teachers. Obviously there were school closures here, and schools were closed and salaries were then cut, which meant that and teachers don't earn a lot of money, like it's a profession, and so you're sort of above the poverty line, but it's about $150 a month, like it's not a lot by any stretch of the imagination. So to have that cut again has just put a lot of people who are actually doing okay and wouldn't be classified as poor in this community have then gone over that threshold, and they're now struggling and they're now kind of on the poverty line. And even though schools have gone back, like people have borrowed money in order to make ends meet, and they've got big debts, and the interest rates are obviously quite high. There was another guy in one of the lodges I stayed at in the capital, Lilongwe, and you get asked for school fees all the time, and I don't mind that. Like, I think people have to use the opportunity where they can. So you end up engaging in a lot of these conversations with people. And so I was asking him about his salary, like, because I always think, oh, well, if you've got a job, like, you're doing okay. You're not like the subsistence farmer in the rural community who is sort of on that poverty line. So he was saying that he was earning, kind of before the pandemic, he was earning about $90 a month, which is just below the threshold for paying tax in Malawi. But because of there's been no visitors, hotels cancellations, that particular lodge had to cut all of the salaries by a third. So he's now on $60 a month. So that's obviously a huge pay cut. So in terms of, even people with jobs are struggling. And then you take into account like transport, everyday living of food, rentals, so in terms of kind of the general population, COVID has had a huge impact. I would say there's a lot more people who are struggling, and then you get the devaluation of the Malawi kwacha, so things become more expensive, but your salaries have been cut. So ultimately, like, for us as an organization, it's meant that we get more emails than we ever have done before from students who are really struggling with school fees and tuition fees. So we work at 8 colleges in Malawi. We've got 92 students at the moment. And, you know, magnify that by 5 emails a day for people in need of fees, it can become very overwhelming. And there's always more that you want to do, and you never have enough for what you for what you kind of want to do, I guess. In terms of kind of the medics and the graduates, we keep in touch with all of our graduates. So we've got over 150 alumni, the majority are doctors. So when, like, Malawi was actually one of the last countries in Africa to record a COVID case, which in some ways gave them a little bit more time to sort of plan what was going to happen. But when you don't have enough doctors and staff already in a health system, has chronic shortages of medical staff. Like, when you've then got staff off who have COVID, your infrastructure sort of is very much on the brink of collapse. So there's definitely been stories that we've heard along the way from graduates where it has been quite confronting, particularly in the early stages, in terms of PPE, they're not being enough. So we ran a campaign in order to supply PPE kits to all of our graduates, which definitely gave me something to focus on in the UK when I was sort of marooned back at that time, but was also an opportunity for us to kind of work with local tailors, provide employment to them at a time when they would be struggling as well. So there's definitely kind of that. I would say that is the sort of first wave and the consequences of that. Currently with Omicron, the latest I heard, so we've had a few graduate dinners, and the latest associated with that was that they had done sort of routine testing and contact tracing of the doctors who did have symptoms, were positive, then they contact traced and tested all of their team, and a lot of them were also turning out positive results but were asymptomatic. So like whole teams were going off the floor for like 4 or 5 days of isolation, and there's nobody else to cover. There is nobody else to go and see those patients. So they sort of changed the policy from what I understand, from you only get tested if you're symptomatic, because if you're not symptomatic, like, you can still carry on seeing patients with your mask, with your PPE, that's all around. Just so that, you know, patients can still get seen and there is still some infrastructure. So I'm not sure if that was actually a summary. Sorry, Guy, no, during a lot of different aspects, but kind of the thing in terms of COVID.
But it's obviously important to support medical graduates in countries like Malawi, because healthcare is so vital, and a pandemic exposes particularly poorer nations to are more exposed than richer nations. So money is obviously an important part of charity work. And where would you want the money to go? Where do you direct the money in the charity? The money that you raise, where does it go?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we don't have any paid employees in the UK or New Zealand where we're registered. We're training up our two administrators in Malawi, and the salaries that we can provide sort of give that opportunity. When you sort of compare the salaries that you'd be giving in the UK for a full-time administrator, then obviously it's not going to be as much as that in a country like Malawi. So essentially what I mean from that is that your donations that we receive are actually really cost effective and economical, because they're not spent on huge salaries of international staff. They go to supporting our beneficiaries and the students and the colleges. So the vast majority of our funds get spent on student tuition fees. And then we've got, we give students a once a semester allowance. Those are our sort of two priorities. And if we have enough cash flow and enough money in the accounts, then we also provide students with medical equipment packs, a laptop and textbooks. So in terms of like equipment packs and things, there are local suppliers in Malawi. So we purchase everything where possible in country, so that we're supporting the businesses of Malawi, contributing in that way. Like, makes far more sense buying here than buying in the UK or New Zealand, and shipping, you have all of those associated costs. So, but in terms of kind of cost of that, so like a stethoscope, it can be, you know, anywhere from 20,000 kwacha to 60,000 kwacha. So in the region, it's kind of $20 to $60. And as I say, if you come from a family of like a dad earning $60 a month, there's no way that you can afford those kind of vital pieces of equipment. And we know that kind of equipment packs, laptops, they do play such a vital role in like medical education here. It's not just a case of all they can borrow from the university. Like, if the university doesn't have enough equipment to go around, and the stuff that is there, like a lot of the time it might be broken or not working or need replacement batteries. So we really try to provide everything to the students, so they're in control of their own learning. There's blackouts quite frequently in Malawi, particularly in rural areas. And that just having a laptop means that they can continue studying after blackouts have occurred. So there's kind of lots of layers to the support that's given. And we know that students with equipment and laptops, they do better at exams. They sort of, yeah, they're more likely to pass exams, more likely to become doctors, physios, pharmacists, you know, whatever course they're studying, they're more likely to pass it. So it really is an investment in education, in health workers. And not only that, like, the students actually provide a lot of service provision where they're training. So I kind of take the example of audiologists. They do a lot of outreach work in rural communities, and the students all go with the faculties to do hearing tests in the villages. And, you know, without students doing that, like, the services that could be provided are really limited as well. So I kind of like to look at the support of a student as you're supporting them individually. They're going to be able to gain professional employment. That gives some job security. That's going to help their family, because the salaries that are provided, they can pay for secondary school fees for siblings. That gives some financial security. But for the health system and for the patients, like, even just supporting a student is such an investment over their time of study. We do get a lot of questions in terms of sort of brain drain and, you know, do your students leave Malawi? And like, we do surveys every year of our alumni to kind of monitor that, and we've got over sort of 97% of our alumni work in Africa, over 93% work in Malawi. So we can definitely show that our students, like, they're not choosing to leave and work in the high income nation. So I think there is a lot of evidence to say, if you support the most needy, the ones most vulnerable, most high at risk of dropping out of their training, actually they're more likely to stay in country, work in these underprivileged rural areas where healthcare needs to be developed, there needs to be more infrastructure, and they really are the leaders of tomorrow. Like, they know what their They know what they need to do. They see it at a village level, like they want to make a difference and make an improvement, and they're sort of our inspiration for keeping going. It's there is such a vital need to provide scholarships to students who are struggling.
And how is it that you raise the money that you spend on all of this great work? What are the funding streams that you have for your charity?
Yeah, that's another great question. So we're very lucky in that we get about 100 donors a month give us a monthly donation. And then we've got people who give one-off donations. So from kind of both of those aspects, we raise probably about 40% of what we need. So there's always more room for more regular donors. And when people sign up to make a donation, then we sort of, in a similar way to kind of sponsor a child schemes, we match them to a student here and then send them like a student update once a semester with our newsletter. So they can sort of see like the progress that the student makes. In terms of other fundraising, so we do have a few fundraising campaigns. We have like recycling campaigns. I'm not sure if anyone's heard of TerraCycle, but we try and use them as much as possible by getting hard to recycle waste and send it in for points, which in turn become cash donations. In New Zealand in particular, we try and do sort of three events a year. We're quite a small team in New Zealand, so we do the Rotorua Hospital raffle around October time, and that manages to raise I think this year it was $2,000. So, you know, not insignificant amounts, but we could always do with more. I'll put it that way, which is charity work is never done, and I think I love the interaction with the students and the program coordination. I think actually I really love that aspect of it, and fundraising I get a kick out of as well, but it also can become quite stressful raising funds when I guess sort of I have the privilege of being able to talk with the students, hear their stories, hear their concerns, but the more students you interview, the more students you listen to, you obviously want to help all of them because there is such a great need, but you have to make these very difficult decisions at times over like when that support can start. Do we have the cash flow for that? So I really try and not meet too many students because I know I can't say no. That's it's very challenging because every student has a story. Every student has a inspiring path that they've been on about the breaks in secondary school that they've had, or they've done odd jobs, or then their mum died and then they had to pay for the funeral. And, you know, all of these stories culminate in a lot of need. And there's always, in terms of fundraising, sorry, back to the original question. So we're hoping to get to the point where we have 100 students a year in Malawi that we sponsor. And then my hope is that we can then develop a donor community where we have enough regular donors to sustain 100 students per year without needing to do additional fundraising. And then that means any kind of additional fundraising that we do can be diverted to supporting students at a new college or in a new country. We're thinking of growing sort of from Malawi, so it would be like Tanzania, Zambia, like other countries which there's huge need for medical education as well.
And you mentioned how you're raising money, but you've also mentioned at the start that you're not being paid to be there, so you're volunteering your time. How many of people like you are there giving their time to help run all of these things?
Yeah, so we've got we've now got registered charitable status in three countries. So the UK, New Zealand, and now Malawi. And within each of those teams, like we've got our board of trustees. None of them are paid. They're all volunteering. We've got our graduates in Malawi as well, who I'm trying to sort of rope into different initiatives, and they're kind of volunteering their time as well. So it's a little bit difficult to put an exact number on that, but we've definitely got volunteers. And in terms of sort of setting things up in Malawi, it is just sort of me at the moment, but definitely got the team at the end of the at the end of WhatsApp to give advice and things when I need. So that's a really helpful source of support.
And going forwards from here, on a personal level, how do you see urgent care and your charity work kind of synergizing? Do you, are you planning on, like you've done at the moment, 3 months or 6 months in Malawi and then come back to New Zealand to work or go back to the UK to work? How do you see your career proceed from here, and how will you going to involve urgent care in that?
Oh, that is a great question. And in a very similar way, my parents ask me that all the time. So what are you going to do next? What's your plan? And I guess I don't really have a fixed plan at the moment. I definitely I love the flexibility of urgent care. I love the fact that it's so generalist, and that really appeals to me in a great way. So how I kind of, the plan for the next 12 to 18 months would be at some stage hopefully get a slot in MIQ back in New Zealand, but time undetermined as yet, and then come back and work for kind of 3 to 6 months as much as I can, reassess how the Malawi side is doing in terms of operations, whether there needs to be another visit to iron out anything else or start up new initiatives. I would really love to do some clinical work in Africa. I love medic to medic. I love the project management side of it. Like, they're definitely skills that I've looking back on, have really feel like I've grown doing this role, but I would love to have that opportunity to work clinically. So I'm hoping that I've got a Mercy Ships job towards the end of 2022. So that would be my plan for the latter little bit of the year. And then in terms of whether that could lead to some other clinical work in international health, I would really love to think it would. But of course, finances and pending, and obviously has to be the right time in terms of travel restrictions and everything like that. So try to be flexible, I guess, in that regard. I'm very open to opportunities, but I definitely, there's definitely a New Zealand visit and work in 2022, and it's definitely sort of home as well. Like, I've been there a long time now, so it I feel like I've been very welcomed by New Zealand and feel very privileged to have that opportunity to sort of come and work there. So in terms of how that fits in with urgent care, like, I will be back in some urgent care clinics very soon, hopefully.
I like the word you use there, flexible, and it's a recurring theme when I speak to urgent care doctors all over the country and indeed all over the world, that the flexibility of the job is what appeals to a lot of people. The flexibility of being able to take time off to go and work up Everest, like Dinesh did, or travel the world, or go and do other things, and that flexibility seems to appeal to people like yourself with an adventurous an adventurous side, people who don't want to necessarily follow the path that is the most trodden, and but to go out and make their own journey and make their own path. And it seems to be a recurring theme for people like yourself, and urgent care seem to be well suited together. And so I would imagine there'd be some people listening to this who have that same desire to help, to get involved with projects like this. So two questions from this. How could anybody listening help your charity and in a maybe a financial way or a supportive way in that way? And is there any need for anybody who does have itchy feet and wants to maybe be a volunteer and help? Is there any windows that people could help in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll answer your second one first, because there's probably a little bit of a shorter, more succinct answer. In terms of international volunteers, I really hope so. So one of the things that we're trying to do for fundraising in country as well is set up a continuous professional development course with the Malawi Medical Council in resuscitation. So my hope is that if we can get this course approved, we'll be able to train some of our graduates in being facilitators and teachers. And then we could offer this package of a CPD resuscitation course in Malawi going around to different hospitals. Now, all of our graduates obviously have full-time jobs, and the demands on their time are very high. So I would hope that at some stage we could use sort of international donors to help facilitate that alongside our graduate alumni, so that there would be a bit of a mix of international experience and sort of local context experience. I think coming into that, like, if you've never seen how it could be or what international medics are doing, I guess if you've never seen how it could be, you don't know how to change things, if that makes sense, or make improvements. So I would hope that we could sort of build that into sort of an international volunteering role, and that wouldn't necessarily have to be a long-term commitment. That could be sort of coming over, supporting that initiative for a couple of weeks if we have various courses booked. But again, like, I have a lot of ideas for fundraising. They don't always come to fruition. And kind of in the theme of being flexible, and Malawi goes at her own pace, we just sort of go with it. So I'm in talks with the Medical Council to get that approved, and also the Ministry of Health to get the content approved. So I guess watch this space in terms of that side. And in terms of the other side, the most help anybody could give is really help with fundraising. Like, that is definitely just such a never-ending, ongoing task. And there are a few different initiatives which might be suited to urgent care. Obviously, if anybody wanted to give a donation, then that would be amazing. In terms of kind of meaningful costs, tuition fees, again, it depends slightly on the college, but overall tuition fees are about $1,000 New Zealand a year. That's excluding the allowances and the equipment that we give. And when I say that, I think obviously that's a huge amount of money, and nobody needs to give that total amount. But I just think, when your reaction is, oh, that's a huge amount of money, like $1,000 New Zealand, yes, it is. And so how on earth can somebody from a rural area on subsistence farming afford that level of tuition fees? So just the meaningful impact of donations are huge when it comes to education, and particularly medical education, I think. So anyway, sorry, that was my promotion for more donations. But in terms of kind of just sustainable fundraising, we're working with a local tailor who's a pharmacist here, who makes just really beautiful scrub tops. She's got a niche in kind of medical clothing and tailoring. So basically we've got scrub tops, which are all in bright African Chitenge colours. So they're all made locally, they're all designed locally. So if anybody wants to purchase any of those, obviously, like, shipping is a little bit of a challenge at the moment in terms of getting that done in the most cost economical way. So we're trying to sort of wait until we get 10 orders for a country before we ship. So if any clinics want to buy Chitenge scrub tops, there's photo albums on the Medic to Medic Facebook page with descriptions. And then there's the instructions of how to order and buy them. So that would be amazing as well, because that will help us kind of build our sustainability around fundraising as well. And then we've got another sort of similarly to a one-off donation, we're trying to run a campaign called Locum for a Day. So that is an idea of Like if there's nothing else that you do for the next 12 months, if you just do one locum shift and donate your pay to Medic to Medic, like you'll be helping to fund like the next generation of doctors, your colleagues in Malawi, in a country that desperately needs them. And then you can see the Medic to Medic Facebook post like guilt-free. I always think my friends must just get so fed up of me resharing Facebook things. But yeah, so in terms of locum for a day, that's something we're trying to push and promote as well. And if any clinics want to kind of sponsor a student as well, that would obviously be amazing. There are other recycling initiatives that you can get involved with as well. Basically, the list is endless. And if anybody is interested, they can definitely message me privately and have a discussion. I'm always more than happy to talk about those things and about how people can get involved.
So you've mentioned the name a few times, Medic to Medic, and you've mentioned Facebook. Can you say how people can find your charity in those spaces? Is it just simply Medic to Medic, or is there any other kind of thing they need to type in?
No, you should just be able to type in Medic to Medic and then our website comes up. We need to give our website a revamp. Apparently it's on quite old software. So if anyone has any technical skills that they can share with that would be amazing. It's just Medic to Medic. Our website will come up, and then we're on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter as well, Instagram as well. So yeah, there's many ways that you can follow us. If you want to get in touch over email, then you can. So our address is info@medic2medic.org.nz. So the two is the letters T-O, not the number two. We'd love to engage with anybody who wants to get involved.
Well, I've said a few times on this podcast that part of the reason we started this was to highlight some of the interesting things that people do around the world with urgent care training and as urgent care fellows. And I think this definitely counts as one of those, that you've obviously had a desire to do this from a young age, and you're living that dream, you're living that career path that you wanted, and you've used urgent care as part of your journey there, which is again goes back to that word flexible. It's a flexible career, and it's a job that gives people skills across such a broad scope of medicine that you can really almost turn your hand to anything. And I think I congratulate you on your hard work, because 150 graduates in a country that needs medical staff more than ever during a pandemic, it must be making a huge difference. So, and to do all this off your own back, self-funded, you deserve a lot of congratulations for all that hard work. And I'd encourage everybody to at least look at what you're doing. And if you got those itchy feet, if Dinesh is listening and he's fancies, I'm sure there's people like him who would fancy getting involved. And hopefully we can get you up over that 100 mark of students that you're aiming for. It would be nice, maybe, Tamsin, in the future to have a chat with you to see how things are going and to kind of touch base and over the coming months and years, just to see how things are going, to see how things are developing, because I think it's fascinating. And as I say, just my hat's off to you. You're doing a great job.
Well, thank you. Oh, thank you. That's really kind. I appreciate all of that. Thank you so much. And it's wonderful to be able to kind of promote the students and Malawi and kind of the challenges to a new network. So thank you so much for having me on. I really do appreciate it. It means so much when people want to listen about what the challenges are. So yeah, just thank you as well.
Well, stay safe over there. I hope you get your spot in MIQ sorted, and that the Omicron wave passes around the world without too much hassle, and that we can see you back here working in urgent care before you go off on your next adventure. So hope to see you soon. But in the meantime, stay safe, and thank you, Tamsin.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Guy.